Geneva is the home of the world's largest water fountain, and it's also the site of a remarkable auto show. What's up with that? GM's serious problem with overweight keychains. And doesn't Consumer Reports like Detroit? And we'll have Lincoln's Elaine Bannon on the Navigator. Bannon, excuse me. She's not going to want to talk to me now. On Navigator's New Direction. And all this and more on AutoLine After Hours.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 231 for February 28th, 2014. Lincoln rolls large.
Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Good evening. I'm Gary Vasilash, editor of Automotive Design and Production. John's not here. I promise you I am not pulling a Jimmy Fallon. John will be back next week. He is out in California right now driving the new GM full-size SUVs. And as I alluded to a little earlier, we'll be talking to the chief engineer of Lincoln's full-size SUV. But I'd like to introduce my journalist colleagues, Mark Phelan of Detroit Free Press, Keith Naughton of Bloomberg News. Welcome, guys. How are you doing?
Good to be here. Thank you.
So what have you been up to?
Hanging out in the auto industry.
Yeah,
you know, nothing ever happens. Yeah. No news.
Okay. So, Geneva. Now, Mark, you've told me for years and years and years that this is one of your favorite auto shows.
It is.
And why is that?
Because it is the only big European show that is held in a country that doesn't have a national automaker, or in the case of the Frankfurt show, which is the biggest of them all, three national automakers. So everybody is on a relatively even playing field.
Neutral territory.
Yeah.
It's Swiss.
Yeah, it's Swiss, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying, there's the world's tallest fountain, and this time of year tends to be the beginning of a sort of a noticeable spring-like season in Geneva, so mm-hmm. There's reasons to want to go there for that as well. This year, there's some really intriguing cars that are going to be, and in fact, most years there are. This is sort of perhaps the first glimmerings of a recovery of the European auto industry, and we'll have a better sense of how the industry feels about that by this time next week.
See, one of the things I found was odd that I did a little research and discovered that there's actually more cars in LA County than there are in Switzerland. So it just seems to be quite an unusual place to do that. But isn't it generally the case that Geneva is where automakers tend to show more exotic or conceptual cars?
That's part of what I find interesting about this year, because usually you're right. The luxury brands come out to play at Geneva, because you're right. I mean, Switzerland's a small, very clean country that doesn't have a lot of people or a lot of cars in it, but it has a whole lot of rich people. So
that,
I mean,
it has wealthy people. That
exactly.
Is
lucky. So Mercedes, BMW, Rolls Royce, Ferrari, they all love to introduce their highest end stuff there. And there is an interesting new Mercedes and an update on some stuff from Ferrari coming, but most of the vehicles this year are smaller and more affordable. There's a really high-performance version of the Opel Astra, which is sort of the Buick Verano. There's the first look for most people at the 2015 Ford Focus. There are rumors about a tiny baby Jeep from Fiat and Chrysler. So for once, the show that usually brings out the richest and the jet set to see all of the new really high end stuff seems to be more in an economy mode.
So it's a pragmatic approach to things. So I saw the Opel Atom rocks. For some reason, it seems like the Europeans are becoming very fascinated with small things with an elevated belt line and seeming as though you're going to be doing, I don't know, climbing the Alps in one of these things, and probably wouldn't have the horsepower to do that.
The Jeep is very important in that way. A small Jeep is what they're looking at to get Jeep to more than a million sales a year, mm-hmm. right? So That would be a huge introduction.
Absolutely. Sure. And like, you know, most Americans who own SUVs, most Europeans don't really need the full capability
right.
of an SUV. So something like the Atom rocks, which I think is raised like this much versus the regular mini car.
It looks bitchin'. I mean,
it really does. You make it look kind of crossover-y, and you can charge an extra $3,000 for it.
Mm-hmm. And what's the one that Fiat has that similarly has sort of a...
There's an all-wheel drive version of the Panda. Mm-hmm. The 500L is sort of the most, I think I'm an SUV, but I'm really not, of all of the Fiat products, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
And there'll be a new Audi TT being shown there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so far only sketches, but I want to see that because the sketches look like a fairly radical departure from where the TT's been for the last three generations.
That hasn't been doing so well for Audi. You don't hear much about that. Why do you suspect that is?
I think Audi has... That was sort of the original car that attracted attention back in the day, and now they've moved up and on. I mean, they're trying to go after bigger fish than a TT will attract.
So... More A8, less right. TT sort of thing.
Yeah, A7, everything. I think that's but I think a TT will fit in nicely in Geneva.
Yes.
I think that's the crowd that would normally be checking out Audi.
And there's a fair number of green vehicles. There's several electrics from Volkswagen and some others. A plug-in hybrid Golf, because apparently you have to have a plug-in hybrid of everything these days. But it's an interestingly different bunch of vehicles this year at Geneva.
And Lamborghini will have a new car, so that'll offset the
yes,
plug-in hybrid vehicles.
That will be the built-in carbon offset for all the plug-in hybrids that are there.
So basically it's like sell one of these Lambo Huracans and then you'd have to sell about 80 of these Golf plug-in hybrids too. No, that's not nice.
Every time you sell one, a Tesla owner cries.
And I always find it fascinating that the Rinspeed, the Swiss design company always comes out with some unusual, exotic
and there's
concept.
Some of the goofiest stuff in the world there.
And
I was trying to remember his name when you asked earlier. There's one guy that he created a wheel that had no hub, and he did a whole car around it. And it was so... Sbarro, like the pizza company.
Uh-huh.
That was it, Franco Sbarro. And for a while there, every year you could count on him to have something that looked like it. You just dropped acid.
Mm-hmm.
And they've toned down the concepts a little bit the last couple of years, too. I think it's probably just sort of a reaction to the lousy economy that lingered in Europe so much longer. So maybe we'll see a few more flights of fancy.
And then Mazda's having the Hazumi concept, which is supposedly the new Mazda 2, a car that few have seen. I mean, the Mazda 2, since it doesn't seem to do very well.
Yeah. And the last of their cars that they've got that still shares its underpinnings with a Ford,
right.
I think. So
right.
when
the Mazda 2?
Yeah, so when because it's a Fiesta, basically. So when the new one comes along, that will be the last vestiges of the Ford Alliance gone pretty quickly, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It feels even quicker than the luxury brands.
Yeah.
Since I think the aluminum F-150 is a child of Jaguar.
Absolutely.
So you're looking forward to a pleasant time in Switzerland?
Actually, sadly, I'm not going to be there this week. Budget, travel budget. The Free Press pays for all its own travel, and that means that we don't get to go to a lot of things that we'd like to, and that a lot of the competition does. So no, I'm
don't
very disappointed.
I'm not going either. So
in that case, are they still going to have the show?
They might. Once they watch the show tonight, it's over. I mean, it's just you guys.
You've got the rundown. What do you need?
Yeah, I mean, just look at the pictures. That's all you need.
Go
just
online.
Stay there. Speaking of newspapers, so yesterday I was in a hotel, and that's when I tend to get my USA Today. And I saw this horrible headline for General Motors. And in case you can't read this, because I don't think I'm on the camera, put it in front of me. All right. So you have it. Oops, get my fingers out of the way. Deaths double. GM widens recall.
It's like two bad headlines for the price of one.
I mean, it's just like, man, oh, man. So Keith, have you done any reporting on what's going on there?
I just want to point out, they doubled from 6 to 13.
Okay.
Which is horrible. One death is horrible.
Sure.
But it does sound like the Hindenburg went down, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
It's a troublesome recall for GM, even though, if you remember, the Ford Firestone deaths were something like 200, just to get a little perspective.
And Ford seemed to be much less willing to accept the possibility that they were to blame.
Ford was kicking and screaming and blaming Firestone, and it was, and Jack Nasser was doing those commercials that were hard to understand. So what GM has done immediately is issue a mea culpa. They have already said, we're sorry, and it's really the fault of our predecessors.
So. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, in the release, Alan Beatty, who's the GM North American president, said, quote, so he's talking about the investigation looking into this problem. He says, the chronology shows that the process employed to examine this phenomenon was not as robust as it should have been. Today's GM is committed to doing business differently and better. We will take an unflinching look at what happened and apply lessons learned here to improve going forward.
As if Alan or Mary Barra and Mark Royce are all new hires.
That's a fair point. So in case folks watching are not familiar with what's going on, they had recalled 2005-2007 Chevy Cobalts, Pontiac G5s, and Pontiac Pursuits, which were sold only in Canada. And separately recalling 2003 to 2007 Saturn Ions from 2006 to 2007, Chevrolet HHRs, and 2006 to 2007 Solstice, and 2007 Saturn Sky models. So it's about 1.3 million vehicles, which is...
But, you know, part of the issue is just how simple and horrific the problem is. So it is. So I have a heavy keychain, and that's going to essentially disable my car. Mm-hmm. The airbags will turn off. The car will turn off when I'm in the middle of highway traffic.
Right.
That really sounds like a horrible way to die. So that's part of the problem. The other thing is that this is really the first big test of Mary Barra. This is where the rubber hits the road for her. Honeymoon over now. How is she going to handle this crisis? And from, you know, the public apology that was issued, you know, in the first news cycle, it seems as if they're going to attack it head on.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting about it. I mean, to be realistic, they do have the opportunity to say it was those guys and they're doing it, but they have accepted, responsibility, I think, and the fact that there was an actual apology.
Right, which the lawyers had to be screaming over. Because that just, opened the liability floodgates.
But wasn't there initially reticence, I mean, that they did the first recall and then...
Right, when it doubled. When everything doubled,
it was raised, the recall. Well, wait a minute, what about these cars? Yeah. Because they basically have the same...
Then I think they realized if we don't start doing something, we're looking like the old GM.
Yeah. Right.
And this is, this is Mary Barra's opportunity to put her stamp on the whole company.
Right.
To say, this is how we treat our customers.
Right. So, they've got to attack it. Kind of lawyers be damned. And that's what they've done so far. I think follow-up is required. I mean, people don't even want to drive their cars for understandable reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the suggestion that they gave to somebody, take it off the key ring so you just have the one key.
Yeah, that was...
I mean, that was really almost...
Yeah, and it's basically what they're saying is that dealers will replace the ignition switch to prevent the unintentional or inadvertent key movement. Until this correction is performed, customers should use only the ignition key with nothing else on the key ring. As always, customers should drive responsibly and use their safety belts. it should be pointed out, though, that, I mean, none of these cars are in production anymore. I mean,
but they're on the road.
They're on the road, but
and they sold a lot of them.
Right.
And a lot of them, and they were basically, for the most part, entry-level models, so you've got a lot of people who bought them for their kids. So, I mean, the only good thing can happen is how they handle it.
Right.
Because everything up to that is a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They've got to move fast. And telling people to park their cars and we'll get to you in April is not going to cut it.
Yeah, it's a big problem. So on to nicer news. So did you guys see the Consumer Reports came out with their list of the best cars? And it was striking to me that I had to go through the list and through the list and through the list to find a car from a traditional domestic manufacturer.
Was there anything on it besides Tesla? That's all I heard.
That's a very good point. So the best car
ever
on planet Earth, possibly in the universe,
in the history of the wheel,
or that too, the Sbarro wheel included, yeah. Hubless, whatever it takes. It's the Model S, and that's the best overall car. But so then the small SUV is a Subaru Forester. Then it goes to the midsize sedan is the Honda Accord with the four-cylinder engine. Which is a very nice car. I like that car a lot. And compact car, Subaru Impreza, midsize SUV, Hyundai Santa Fe, green car, Toyota Prius, and drum roll please, pickup truck, Ram 1500. Luxury car, Audi A6, the aforementioned Audi, so, you know.
Moving up, baby.
Get rid of that TT. sports sedan, BMW 328i, and minivan, Honda Odyssey. So, Mark, you've undoubtedly driven every single one of these cars several times. What do you think? Do you think they got it right?
I think that there's no terrible cars on that list. There are, you know, there are others that I would prefer in many of the segments. Oddly enough, I mean, you singled out the Accord, you know, for loving it. The Accord's got one feature that just annoys the hell out of me. Theoretically, it's a blind spot alert, but instead of lighting up when there's somebody in your blind spot, whenever you use your indicator, a huge video screen shows you a picture behind you. I find that endlessly distracting, but that's a minor thing. But no, I mean, you know, those are for the most part fine cars, and I have to say, we're flooded at the Free Press and probably other outlets with people saying, oh, Consumer Reports, they hate the domestics, they've got it in for us. No, they really don't. I mean, they test, they have their own test, and they apply it fairly, and it is a perfectly defensible set of tests. And there are times when they say great things about the domestics as well, and when they do, the domestics, you know, buy billboards to promote it. So, I mean, they have to be willing to live with the fact that they got hammered here. One of the things that I find most interesting is that a lot of the hammering seems to be, you know, attributable to touch screens and bad control systems.
Right.
Because Ford and Cadillac both, they singled out as you know, getting a lot of damage from bad touch screens. And I frankly think that Cadillac's, you know, control system is terrific. So that's one where I would disagree with them. But it's... I mean, everybody has their own set of standards. They apply to theirs, you know, reasonably. Yeah, you can quibble, but, you know, on the whole they're right. One other thing that I do find interesting, yesterday Jim Healy in USA Today did a story where he picked out what are the worst vehicles that they Consumer Reports named in a bunch of segments, and they were predominantly imports as well. Mm-hmm. And so, if anything, that further, you know, goes to the idea that they're not playing favorites and
right.
going out of their way to hammer people. Everybody's got, you know, good and bad. And one thing that I do find particularly tricky about the way about evaluating Consumer Reports tests is that they will give a different grade frequently to the four-cylinder Accord from the V6 Accord,
right.
And that leads to some confusion at times.
Well, I mean, I think that because they say their metrics are test performance, reliability, and safety, and so, you know, when they're looking at
and what their readers say, and very reasonable,
right? And they had 1.1 million readers, and actually they agree with you about the Accord, by the way, because they have just avoid the Honda Link infotainment system that comes on the EXL versions. We can't recommend those versions because of reliability problems, but. It's basically that's the version that you're talking about.
Yes.
So they're actually with you on that. And and then they did another thing. So in addition, and let's not lose sight of the fact that the Tesla is actually made in a former General Motors plant in California. So it's a domestic car.
You know, the issue is Ford has been banished from the tops of these lists until they get my Ford Touch fixed. Mm-hmm. And of course, the big news of this week is they're dropping Microsoft and going with the BlackBerry operating system. Hopefully that'll fix the problem. I mean, there was a time when BMW was being killed in these sorts of surveys by iDrive. So if they can get a system that will function intuitively and that will function reliably, then Ford, because of all the other things they're doing well, will move back up the charts. Mm-hmm. But for now, they are banished to the cellar.
See, you know, I was wondering about this, you know, so, you know, the BlackBerry operating system, QNX, which, so QNX was a company that existed, and Research in Motion, that's the previous name of BlackBerry,
right?
And so they bought this company. They probably didn't even know they had that company, I'm willing to bet, because they're
That will be a huge revenue source.
It'll be a huge revenue source. But so basically it's a Linux-based system rather than the Microsoft, which is using a Microsoft-based operating system. You know, and it sort of struck me that, okay, if it only been QNX, if BlackBerry didn't own it, would have anybody have talked about it? I mean, it just sort of struck me that this is you know, buzzworthy because BlackBerry.
This could save BlackBerry. You know, certainly their phones aren't saving them, are
right.
they? So this becomes the target of Dayton Hudson's, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So if it works, and Ford, my goodness, that's millions and millions of vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody could want to be QNX BlackBerry. Mm-hmm.
But just imagine that here we are sitting talking about operating systems for
I love the fact that we're talking about the thing that may save BlackBerry, frankly. And I've never owned one. I just would have been sorry to see them go away. A nice little Canadian company. Mm-hmm. You know, you wish them well. You know, congratulations on the gold medals.
Actually, they have an instant messaging operating system that they're thinking about because Facebook paid, $19 billion for WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And they think that they have that. So the head of BlackBerry thinks that that's going to save them. So they may have a double save here.
I think Ford's going to save them. If anything will save them, Ford will save them.
Or maybe they'll save Ford. But part of what's going on, though, I mean, Ford's going to continue to be hammered for years because these cars, like the killer keychains, these cars are going to still be in production or still be in, you know, on the road for years, and
that's
people will be annoyed by them.
I want to see in the free press.
Killer keychains from outer space. Yeah. Ford's got an ongoing problem because they built cars that had a bad system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've both noticed every new vehicle that they show us, they go out of their way to say, yes, it still has voice recognition and all that, but look, we've discovered buttons and dials, and we're going to have those too.
Rediscovered. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're doing everything they can to, you know, remedy the problem. Because you're right. Consumer Reports, you know, was singing their praises, you know, from the highest mountains 3 years ago.
Right.
And
yeah.
Almost purely due
all
to
went to
my Ford
basket
Touch.
Yeah. Because of MFT. Yep.
Right. They also nicked them for their transmissions on the.
That's true.
So, yeah. So let's not lose sight of the fact that cars are machines.
But it's a software problem.
So are computers.
I don't have many gears. It's
Gary, you got to get with the connected car, dude. You're being so 20th century
now. I am. But,
you really are.
Mm-hmm. So let's see what else here. So then they did which I thought was interesting, they did a brand report card. And Lexus came out on top of that.
And I'm shocked.
But what I think was shocking was the one that came in number two, Acura. So what's going on? You know, and earlier this week there was that change of management that American Honda announced, including taking Eric Berkman and giving him a new title at Acura. Business something or other.
Well, it's interesting because even Consumer Reports' own people distance themselves a little from particularly squirrely results, and Acura being number two strikes me as a fairly squirrely result because the cars are not that good for the most part, but the quality certainly is.
Sure.
There was times when during their last recommended. Things Gone Wrong survey. I was talking to Jake Fisher, their head of testing, and the Lexus RX 500 got a great score. And I said, but why? It has that horrible little joysticky control thing, which I think is diabolically difficult to use in a moving vehicle. And he said, yes, we hate that too, but we don't score that on this test. So Acura strikes me as a bit of an anomaly.
Okay. So one more subject, then we'll take the break, then we'll bring out our guest. So the Tesla Gigafactory.
That is the biggest thing since the Rouge.
6,500 jobs somewhere to build batteries.
Right.
And,
he's going total vertical integration, just like Henry Ford. So Elon is the new Henry Ford.
Possibly, yes. So what do you think about that? I mean,
do you see what their stock is selling for?
An enormous
$250 a share.
Right.
God, wouldn't any Detroit company kill for that? We can shoot bullets all we want at Elon Musk, and he'll just keep winning.
So why do you think that is?
Will the people who invest in the company at $250 a share, do you think?
I mean, they're getting it now.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
Because they just put a new debt offering
on. He's made a lot of millionaires.
Yep.
And he's selling cars. And he's shooting rockets into space.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So the guy is just making it happen.
He's the Iron Man.
Okay. All right. So we'll take our commercial break right now. And our good friends at Bridgestone Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
And we are back. So I would like to introduce our guest. She's Elaine Bannon. She's the chief engineer at Lincoln for the Navigator. And before I turn these guys on you, just tell us how you became the chief engineer of a giant SUV.
So, it's been a long journey. I'll have 30 years with Ford Motor Company this year. And the past 12 or 13 years, I've been doing a chief nameplate engineer job and started off with commercial truck, did a lot of comm truck, did Edge and MKX, and worked really with Lincoln almost 10 years now. Now I do Lincoln exclusively. MKX, MKT, Navigator is what I'm working on now. But I think it's really about, I love system engineering. I love the idea of taking that complex machine that you guys were talking about, the machine, and putting soul into it. For me, there's a humanity, an organic feel to putting something out there that has that mix of that excellence in system engineering and that soul, which is the magic that kind of makes that vehicle stand out. So I love doing that. I love it. And here I am.
what made you go into automotive in the first place? I mean, that's...
My brother and my uncle, this is way back now, are engineers. And, I grew up around, restoration projects. And, I mean, I just was immersed from... many moons ago, I don't know how to describe it. I just love it. For me, when you have a vehicle, there isn't anything more personal that somebody's going to bring into their lives, like a partner in their life, like a vehicle. And I just always felt that way. It's a partner. And if you do it well, it's like almost like a human being. And I think of my vehicles that I work on as my children. And I just... Ever since I can remember, that's what I've wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really just was that for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's
great.
Yeah.
So, do you see lots of other young women who are also pursuing engineering in auto companies, or would you like to see more?
When I started almost 30 years ago, you didn't see many women in even the engineering, your classes and that. Certainly there's more. And I would say this, if you have to love what you do, If you love the ideas, the complex, you know, machine, the engineering and all that goes into that, and you feel like you love that and it's your passion, I would encourage women or men, young people to do that. But you know how tough it is now, right? We work and it's intense and it's competitive. And if you don't love what you do, you're going to burn out. So no matter what, you have to love it. Mm-hmm. And if you do love it, go for it.
Mm-hmm. So you seem to be very engaged and very happy with what you've chosen
mm-hmm.
to do, and
absolutely.
And now you have another vehicle that you'll have your
mm-hmm. my signature, my mojo. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Guys,
you know what I'm wondering, Elaine, is mm-hmm. about the durability of the Navigator, because yeah. you know. Truck-based large SUVs are supposed to be out of fashion, and yet the Navigator continues to, in many ways, drive Lincoln sales. You've tried many other things on the car side of the business, but the good old Navigator just keeps chugging along. Weren't we over these big SUVs? Why does this one sustain? And, you know, you could say the same of the Escalade, by the way.
So let me talk about that and then talk about the total Lincoln. We have a 70% loyalty on Navigator, and actually the segment is very stable at about 50 to 55,000 vehicles a year. You know, I view working on Navigator, it's an icon, really, and it is a vehicle that people who are very, you know, they have an outdoor lifestyle. You know, 92% of the people that buy a Navigator are married, making $200,000 plus in income, and they are looking to make an intelligent purchase with their lifestyle, their families, and what they want to do with, you know, our best-in-class cargo, our best-in-class towing. The vehicle suits their needs. And for that person that are there and they're loyal, you know, we felt now, given what we've done on the MKZ and the upcoming MKC, it was the time to focus on the Navigator. And I'm very excited about what you're going to see in dealerships.
But I guess I just wonder, it is a successful vehicle, mm-hmm. but does it help with the transformation of the Lincoln brand, since it's an old school big SUV? The sort of things that Detroit supposedly left behind.
So let's talk about Lincoln brand. So we are about maybe 3 years into this intense, laser-focused, you know, working on Lincoln. We know it takes a very long time to really, you know, bring that to where we want it to be, which is a true luxury brand experience. And the MKZ, when we introduced that in April, sales have increased 40% on the Z. You know, the transaction price has increased $7,000, and it did win, you know, J.D. Power appeal. That's just the Z. The C that we showed you in last year, and it's coming out later this year. The C, it's the fastest growing luxury segment. That's sub premium CUV, and that is fastest growing. MKZ represents the largest of luxury segment. So we're really got a foothold with the Z. The C is the fastest growing in luxury, and we have this amazing offering that's coming out that's really going to appeal to our customers. If you look at that segment, since 2012, it's increased 25%, and since 2009, 200%. And we've got an amazing fun-to-drive, aspirational, all EcoBoost lineup, MKC, coming out to really grab those luxury customers. And now we've got the Navigator. And you see, the Navigator is a loyal base. And let's put it this way. You have to look at the lineup and say, what vehicle fits my lifestyle? What vehicle fits my lifestyle? And if you are looking for a premium vehicle in a large SUV, and you want the seating and the cargo, the power and the performance and the towing, and be surrounded by luxury, I don't view that as at all antiquated. It's about meeting the needs of our customers and being personal to our customers by meeting those needs.
So it's a demographic that's still very relevant.
Absolutely.
And you would prefer to have something in the game rather than let your competitors on the other side of town take it all, since they're not giving up on that.
And, you know, when I think about CUVs and and SUVs. You think about, we've got the C coming out. We have the MKX. We have the MKT. We have the Navigator. You have that utility vehicle. That's such a great type of vehicle for people's lifestyles. And now you've got a choice in size and in kind of design and in performance and all of those things that appeals to a wide range of people. And I think that's really powerful for a luxury brand to have that.
So you have extra large, large, medium, and small.
That's a simplified, yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, Keith's point about it being in some ways the sort of vehicle that Detroit used to make more than does now. I was looking at it almost the exact opposite way. I think of the Navigator as sort of being the last icon that Lincoln created, because you were there first. You were the one who showed everybody else. People will think of an SUV as a luxury vehicle, and there is almost no limit to how shiny, how big and shiny you can make it. And it has, over the years, you know, as other competitors have come along, it has been eclipsed by some of them. And I was wondering, as you were doing the new one, what did you see as the things that can cross-pollinate between what a Navigator is and the new models and vice versa? I mean, how do you use them both to make the brand more coherent and to kind of raise the brand?
So, you know, when I think about luxury, I think about quality, but when you think about luxury, it's almost like crafted quality or design. It has to be stunning design. And in the case of a personal experience, a personal service experience, it's also about personal technologies, where it's not technology for technology's sake, but it's providing an intuitive and making your life easier. And so when you think about those elements of luxury, and then you look at Navigator, and, you know, kind of taking a look at what we did, the personal elements of the Navigator around our Lincoln Drive Control is an example, with our continuously controlled dampening suspension. So I can set the mode of the suspension in a comfort, a normal, or a sport mode. And you've got multiple vehicle sensors monitoring every 2 milliseconds and that, and really keeping it true to that setting. But it's the idea that I can choose that setting, and that's personal luxury to me. You see that element in the C and the Z, the idea that I'm making that a personal experience for me. And I think that when you think about it that way, where that vehicle, again, like I said earlier, it's my partner, and I think about, well, how is the customer going to use the vehicle, and how can I help make that just an amazing relationship? And so that's just an example of the debt technology and that bridging technology that we have in Lincoln that makes it personal to me and comfortable for me, in that case, to drive the vehicle.
So is what generation would this vehicle be from the start?
So the vehicle, this is the 17th year.
Wow.
And you would say we had the original, we had an update, another update, and then this maybe the third or the fourth update to the vehicle, I would say, over time. Now, there's always things that go on year over year. So when we talk about it in terms of that, someone might say that may be more significant than other years, because there's always the continuous improvement. There's always things you're doing to the vehicle. So it put it in terms of, you know, you're constantly working on your baby, you know, to make it better and better and all these little ways and all, like I talked about, with the system engineering and the refinement. But this is a major update to the vehicle.
So sort of to Keith's point that, If we were to go back 17 years ago and we had the Navigator from then and you put the new one next to it.
Yeah.
So in a sense, this could be old technology, but this new one would be as advanced as anything that would be out there, short of something with, I don't know, Elon Musk's name on it. No.
You know what I love to point out is, first of all, we have the 3.5 liter EcoBoost. And
that's the only engine that's going to be available.
That's correct.
So V8 is gone.
V8 is gone. We've got, you know, I mentioned this earlier, over 370 horsepower, over 430 foot-pounds of torque. It's going to have great...
Both of those higher numbers than what the old V8 gave you.
Right. The old V8 was 310 horse and 365 torque. And when you think about that, and we haven't published fuel yet, but it's going to be very solid, very solid. You know, you've got the great towing capability, which is best in class because of the torque curve and the low-end torque. So that technology, being able to provide that utility to the customer in that very cutting-edge technology in that powertrain is an example of that. I mean, think about our independent rear suspension. We have an independent rear suspension. What that is important for our customer is not just a smoother, more controlled drive and ride experience. We have an authentic fold flat floor. Now, there's all sorts of angles of flat, but when I'm walking up to the vehicle, power liftgate goes up and I'm armed with my groceries, I want to be able to put them in there and have them stay there so when I get home, nothing's rolling out on to my garage floor. And so, you know, that's saying something about, just as an example, the suspension and the powertrain.
And in this class of vehicle, you are very rare in having an independent suspension.
Correct.
Yeah. And talking about what generation is it, for like product geeks, you know, like us, I think part of what makes it hard to figure out is that you do have the independent suspension. Mm-hmm. So we've never thought of it as being sort of in lockstep with the evolution of the F-150, mm-hmm. because it's different in that very mm-hmm. big way. Mm-hmm. But if you, to the extent that you can take the rear suspension out of consideration, mm-hmm. it is more or less, you know, in evolving in conjunction with the F-150 over the years. So it would be a couple of, you know, platform changes since the
Oregon, there are obviously are common elements that we've had in the body structure and to some degree between the Navigator and others. We have some hydroform front end and some technology there that is, but again, like you said, the utility of the product and what we're doing and the luxury piece of it certainly sets it apart.
It's funny, too, because, I mean, one of the things that Ford and Lincoln have got for years have been the push-button entry, mm-hmm. and other car companies don't understand those and they never put them in. Every Ford and Lincoln owner I've ever spoken to who has that wouldn't give it up for anything. Yeah. And I suspect that your fold flat seat is the same. They don't, many of them don't know or care that it's because you get a different suspension. They just want that seat to disappear.
See, that's exactly it. You know, we have to engineer the system to the lifestyle of that customer. And for somebody that's buying that vehicle, and when you think about just best-in-class cargo, well, I'm buying a vehicle because I'm bringing a bunch of stuff along. I'm bringing my family. I'm bringing my hobby. So isn't that important to have that? The best-in-class third-row legroom. I've got a third-row seat. Is it genuine? Is it genuine for me when I need that? And so, to me, anytime I'm going into a project and engineering it, it's all about the lifestyle and, of course, the luxury expectation of those of that product. Because, that you know, people want to just fall in love, and then you want them to fall in love again and buy it again, and that's the loyalty factor. And that's our job, is to work on all that detail and that attention to detail, to deliver it in a way that feels effortless to everyone else.
You mentioned the 70% loyalty yeah. rate on the Navigator. Mm-hmm. I'm betting that the Lincoln Town Car had loyalty rates that high or higher, and yet, you know, Lincoln literally did a commercial where they set the town car on fire to leave that behind, you know, burn the village to save the village, I guess. I'm wondering if the Navigator will bring in new customers to Lincoln, or is that more the job of the MKC and the Z?
So I really couldn't comment on the loyalty of the town car, so, you know, don't have those numbers. But let's think about what we're doing to the Nav. Where we're touching it, where we touched it very specifically, was to meet the customer's needs. I didn't really talk about the beauty element, you know, what we did to bring it into the Lincoln family and the attention to detail, as well as the capability and the power that we talked about. So do I expect conquest sales for Navigator? I do. I do expect that. And I do expect that with C. And certainly we have evidence with the Z based on our sales and our momentum there. It's all about being personal to meeting the needs of your customer and doing it in an elegant, refined way. When I think about the exterior of the vehicle and what we've been able to do and the attention just in the lamps, you know, we have over 200 LEDs in just the exterior lighting because we needed to make it feel right, to look like the jewelry it needed to be. It's a Navigator. And we did, it was, hey, whatever this took to get that soul, the soul, which I think a lot about the lamps is kind of the soul, you know, and the glow, was what we were going to do. And so I absolutely expect that.
That new buyers will come in seeing this beautiful vehicle.
I'm sorry?
New buyers will come into the brand seeing the vehicle.
Does the recent run-up in fuel prices concern you at all as your new car is ready to roll?
I mentioned that, you know, we haven't announced our fuel story, right, but it's a good one. And frankly, based on the loyalty, if you take a look at this segment, I had mentioned that's been very stable at about 50 to 55,000 for a long period of time. This segment of buyer, of course, they are very conscious. They want the vehicle that suits their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that and with the technology that we put in the vehicle, I'm confident of that moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the segment is basically you and Escalade.
There's Infiniti QX80.
I was wondering if you thought of that, if you mm-hmm. considered them as
in and the Lexus LS.
And the big Lexus as mm-hmm. well. Not mm-hmm. the Mercedes GL, though.
Not as much.
Okay, thank you.
You know, yet when I do something, I do look at the adjunct groups, because you do need to understand the broader luxury. And, you know, given the fact that I have MKX and MKT, and I'm always looking at, you know, what's going on and how do I want to make these vehicles personal to the customer. But, yes, those are the core.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have a whole bunch of people who have questions for you. I don't know if you can answer this one, but David Crockett wants to know, as the Zephyr's name was changed to MKZ, will the Navigator's name be changed to MKN?
Navigator is a Navigator.
Navigator is Navigator. You probably can't answer this one either. Wright Knight wants to know, why not do a premium sedan off of this strong full frame?
You know, again, we feel we've got a lineup and we're working on things, you know, that I can't discuss today that are really going to meet and will meet our customers' needs. So
let me change that question a little bit.
Okay.
Just from a pure engineering point of view.
Sure.
Does a body-on-frame car have any possibility of existing in a reasonable way? I mean, yes. I mean, you do something one-off. But, I mean, just from an engineering point of view, is it more efficient to have a unibody than a body on frame?
From a car point of view, just given what you want to do with the connected, you know, if you're talking about a car, I would definitely be with a unibody, mm-hmm. definitely. Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're like not likely. I mean, you guys or the guys down the street or the guys.
I couldn't
across,
really, you know,
but,
again,
but
like
mean, but just pure engineering.
Pure engineering. You know, you never say never because you know how it is in life. But I think you can. Our offerings kind of speak for themselves that way.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Botox wants to know: was the Navigator engineered to a standard or to a price point?
Oh. I mean, I've mentioned this a couple of times, so I hope I don't sound, but I view having the Navigator as like a joyful burden. It is an icon. It just flat out is. And so when we approached it, this was about making whatever it took, making it right. You know, when we put in more quietness technologies into the product as well for the 15, you know, this was about whatever it takes. Hmm. This is Navigator. This is luxury. This is... Yeah, that it just speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm. So you guys really tried to do
absolutely
whatever you could,
absolutely
whatever it would take to
absolutely
make it happen.
Definitely.
Okay. Goat Rope says Land Rover uses aluminum to knock 900 pounds or so from its SUV, and the F-150 is going aluminum. Why didn't Lincoln lead the way with the Navigator?
So, yes, aluminum is a great technology, and yes, F-Series has aluminum. This vehicle is, although it's significant, it's not an all-new vehicle for us. It's a very significant freshening.
Mm-hmm.
So to say that in the future we may or may not go to that technology, I really couldn't say.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, you know, those choices are out there for us.
Do you have some aluminum on it already? Is the hood aluminum?
We do. The liftgate.
Liftgate,
actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Goat Rope also wants to know, and you sort of alluded to this, please name three areas in which the Navigator is best in class in the premium SUV market.
Ah, okay. Well, I had mentioned them, but we have the best in class towing. We have best in class total cargo. We actually have best in class cargo behind the first, second, and third row. And we also have the best in class legroom,
mm-hmm.
third row legroom.
Will you have the best in class fuel economy?
So we haven't published our fuel numbers yet, so stay tuned.
Do you think of the Navigator and the L as two different vehicles, by the way? Like Tahoe and Suburban, mm-hmm. for instance.
The Navigator and the Navigator L, you mean?
Yeah.
You know,
maybe explain what the difference is.
Okay, so the Navigator L is an extended length Navigator, and it provides about 25 cubic feet more of cargo area than that. So I wouldn't call it completely unique, but what we did when we introduced that was really give the customer the choice of wanting that more of that cargo and that utility to be able to have that choice.
And can you say anything about how they split up sales between the two models?
The Navigator versus the L, it's probably 75-25, something like that, 70-30.
Mm-hmm. With the Navigator being the predominant one.
The Navigator regular,
yeah. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for interrupting.
I'm sorry.
I interrupted viewers. That's wrong.
No, this is she's here to answer questions from everyone.
I love it.
So, okay, tell us a little bit about, so you're also working on the MKX. Mm-hmm. You were the mother of the MKX.
I was. And I am.
So that's the midsize.
It is.
Premium that you have. And so are you also providing incremental improvements to that vehicle? Is that, or?
You know, I can't talk about future.
I just thought I would throw that out there.
But it's okay if you ask. I just can't talk about that.
Uh-huh. No. Will you be even happier some months from now?
I enjoy every vehicle I'm working on, and I'm actively working on my vehicles.
Okay. So that sounds like you'll be happier because you like doing what you do.
Let me just ask you about, if not X, you can talk about S a little bit, right? So why is that the fastest growing segment? Why do people want basically a small SUV, and where are they coming from?
Mm-hmm. That for the MKC?
C, I'm sorry, I said S, didn't I? C is what I meant to say.
So,
excuse me.
Interestingly,
sorry.
So they're coming from two places. We've got people that want to enter the luxury segment that weren't in the luxury segment that are looking for that smaller premium. And so we're actually conquesting new, and that's why you're seeing the segment grow. And when I talked about, you know, 2009, since 2009, it's grown, you know, 200%. You're seeing new people into the luxury market. And you're also seeing people who are current luxury customers that, for whatever reason, empty nesters or what have you, they're moving to, they want a smaller offering, but they also want the utility that a CUV or an SUV provides. So you're seeing an influx there and an influx of really new luxury customers, and hence a fairly large growth. And like I said, the fastest growing luxury segment.
So what are the odds that the chief engineer for the MKC, Lisa Drake, and you, dealing with the other vehicles, are women? Isn't this strange? I mean, I know it's the year of the woman, but
you know, here's how I view this. I view it as, if I'm really good at what I do, and I've been doing it a really long time, and then the products that I, with the team, right, with the team, because it's a huge, complex system, speak for themselves. So whether I'm a man or a woman, honestly, for as long as I've been in this business, you know, it's really about that for me. And, you know, my life experience as a woman certainly brings different things, but so does everybody's life experience. We all have things that we're bringing to the table. And to me, it comes down to, can you execute with the team something amazing? And, you know, I think that speaks for itself. I really do.
I interrupted you, Mark, so.
Oh, I was actually going to ask a kind of a conceptual question, because we were talking about the different sizes of SUVs, and the C is coming. Do you think that there is a meaningful level of interest in a class smaller than that? Things mm-hmm. like the Encore, the mm-hmm. BMW X1.
Mm-hmm.
I find them very interesting, and among other things, the fact that everybody has decided to call things the size of the X their small SUV, it troubles me because I don't know what to call these new things.
I do think that when you take a look at luxury, there's other places you could play. And so the question is, you know, where do you go? And with the lineup that we have, with the C, the X, the T, and the Nav, you know, that's a nice scope of product for the different sizes and the different needs and the different feelings, frankly, the soul, the different feelings that the product has. So that's kind of where we're playing right now. But definitely, I mean, when you look around, there's certainly other future things that we may look at.
It almost seems that cars don't have a future anymore. I mean, it's because everybody's going to these small crossover type vehicles.
To buy a hatchback if you just tell them it's a crossover.
Right.
You know?
You know, and when the Adam Opel Rocks comes, I mean, we'll just be,
yeah.
Just be all over the whole thing. It's just, you notice how it comes full circle. Okay, so here's a question that I want to ask Keith, and so you can chime in though. All right, and so this is Anton Wallman wants to know if any other automakers such as GM or Ford announced that they were investing in a new battery factory that would be ramping in revenue from 2018 to 2020, would they too see an increase in their market value close to $10 billion?
No, I don't think so. I think Tesla is trading like a tech stock. It's certainly not trading like an auto stock. And that's what's driving it up. It's a tech play for investors. It's not an auto play. And the more he does things like that, making himself about batteries and technological advancement, the more his stock will trade like a tech stock, which, you know, is good and bad, right? Because they rise very, very high and fall very, very far.
So what if he were making 12-volt batteries that are in...
Well, he wouldn't do that.
Right.
So.
But I mean, just so it's because he's making
advanced technology,
not high-tech batteries that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Not antiquated technology that we still will continue to use for the foreseeable future.
Right.
Okay. Just I knew you'd know the answer to that because I sure as hell didn't, and she couldn't answer.
But if Elaine has a thought, I would welcome it.
Well, I think you covered it well.
I mean, what's your sense? Again, as an engineer, of hybrid vehicles, of hydrogen vehicles, of electric vehicles, I mean, where's this all playing out? I mean, is powertrain going to be various things rather than, you know, a monolithic internal combustion engine that we've had for the last 110 years or so? I mean, do you see a lot of variety?
I do see, you know, the variety. I think that it'll be interesting to see, you know, how it'll play out from an infrastructure standpoint in the United States. The idea that, you know, really at the end of the day, do the alternative fuels and that, how do they meet needs and how does the infrastructure support that? I think it's very important to have those technologies and pushing the envelope on those. I think it's important for a lot of reasons. Moving technology forward in any way, in all of those ways, is how we got to where we are today. Mm-hmm. So the idea that you would never do that is absurd. So pushing that technology, working on them, getting all of those ideas, and frankly, the breakthroughs to even get to the next thing is critical. Because as when you look way back, how would we have gotten here had we not pushed? So, yes, I do think it's important. Yes, I think it's important to explore the different alternative fuel technologies. And I think it's also going to be interesting to see how our infrastructure moves forward with them.
Mm-hmm. Elaine, do you think there'll be an autonomous Lincoln someday?
Well, you know, like I say, can't talk about that stuff.
So. But I'm curious. I love an engineer's point of view on just separate it from Lincoln and make it a future product discussion. What do you think about the future of autonomous cars?
You know, I know that there's some work going on with that right now, and I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting from a technology standpoint. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's almost a similar answer to what I just talked about with the alternative fuels, because it is also about the infrastructure that's going to be in place or not when we talk about that. So, I would push all the technologies in that area to understand them better, to learn from them, to really understand what it means to our customers. Is it valued? And what would it mean to society's infrastructure to do that? I think it's important to push. But I think it's in the infancy stages of it, and we'll have to see how it moves forward. Mm-hmm. But again, as an engineer and learning and understanding, it's very interesting. And I think it's critical to make breakthroughs even in unintended areas.
Will it be difficult, though, to understand what a consumer wants when it's a technology that they don't know anything about? It makes me think of the old Henry Ford famous quote of, if we would have asked our customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we're pushing the envelope in ways that it's almost anticipated needs, because that's just like everything. In a lot of other consumer segments where you're doing that, mm-hmm. and you hit upon something that strikes a chord. So, like I said, it's important to push all of those areas and see what you get out of it. And again, are there any unintended byproducts that really are the breakthrough here? And that's why it's important to really push those technologies.
It's like a moonshot.
Oh, we have someone on the telephone who has a question for us. So, Ben, bring it in. It'll come out of there.
Yes, this is Roger from Fairfield, Connecticut. I was just curious for your guest, the Lincoln engineer, as to why they were not using that wonderful 5-liter engine that they can still get in the Ford pickup trucks and the Mustang for that nice smooth and quietness and reliability versus the smaller EcoBoost. Great show. Thanks for the feed. Thank you.
5-liter engine.
Yeah, and I talked about it a little earlier with the 3.5-liter EcoBoost. When you really look at the numbers and what we're delivering, you know, over 370 horsepower, 430 foot-pounds of torque, the low-end torque curve providing the best-in-class towing, and what we will see as very respectable fuel economy, you know, that's really what's important. And, you know, you have to look at it differently from V6 to V8. It's really about, are we delivering to the customer's needs? Are we delivering to their lifestyle? Mm-hmm. And I'm confident that we are.
For the level of noise and vibration mm-hmm. that Lincoln customers will want in a vehicle like mm-hmm. this, did you have to make any different accommodations, any different technology, because you were using the V6 and the turbocharging mm-hmm. and direct injection?
I mean, it's coming back to the system engineering. When you're applying, you know, a powertrain into, you know, another unique vehicle, you're always going through and you're doing your tuning. You're doing your all the things that we do in the iterative process to make sure we're delivering to the quietness and all of that. And like I mentioned, we did put a quietness bundle in with the multiple technologies in the bundle to make sure that we're delivering to what our customers' expectations are. So the tuning process is absolutely there every time you're approaching a vehicle because it's just about how the system is interacting with each other.
And we have another phone call.
Hey guys, Drew in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Just a question about the Navigator. Why is the Navigator, when the rest of the Lincoln lineup all comes with a MK followed by a letter name, why has the Navigator retained its proper name? All right, thank you.
The Navigator, like I talked about with the 70% loyalty, Navigator is Navigator. But I will say that the MKZ, as far as recognition in that, is actually number one in our nameplates, and then Navigator, because when you're putting that time and investing that time in socializing the nameplate, it is going to resonate. And that's what we're seeing. But Navigator is Navigator, and it's an icon, and it'll remain so.
And as you notice, he said its proper name, Navigator. So that's, I think that says it all.
It's a great name.
So,
yeah.
Well, right. And when the changeover to the new generation of the other vehicles, you know, was beginning, Navigator was arguably the one vehicle, and I'm not asking you to comment on this at all, but I would say that Navigator was arguably the one vehicle in Lincoln's lineup that people said, oh yes, I've heard really good things about that one. So there was no reason to go away from that name. I'm not asking you to comment.
She wouldn't disagree. She's yeah. It's a great car. It's a great car. So final question.
Sure.
When will your Navigator be on the road? When will people be able to buy one?
Early fall of
Early
this
fall.
Year. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So with that, we're just over an hour, and I promised these guys that I'd do it as an hour, and they didn't believe me. They were right, because it's over an hour. So I want to thank you, Elaine Bannon.
Thank you so much.
From Lincoln.
Really a
Chief
pleasure.
Chief Engineer coming in.
Just a pleasure.
Thanks.
Mark Phelan, who will not be in Geneva, so cancel the show.
Sad Mark.
And Keith Naughton from Bloomberg. Thank you for coming in today. Okay, and thank you all for joining us. John McElroy will be back next week, along with our guest Calvin Visser from Fierce Fuel Systems. So we'll see you then. Thank you.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at Autoline Lincoln.tv.